Hi there, and thanks for joining me today on Geese of Gear, episode number 219. Today's podcast is brought to you by Elation Professional. This year at LDI, Elation premiered the highly anticipated successor to the Proteus Hybrid, called Proteus Hybrid Max. The Proteus Hybrid Max takes everything you've loved about the pioneering Proteus Hybrid and cranks it up to maximum power. This isn't just an update, however. Faster, brighter, and tougher than its groundbreaking predecessor, the IP66 Proteus Hybrid Max features all new technology, like fast advanced features, tri-tier animation, and spin sync tracking that makes it a breakthrough evolution in lighting excellence. It boasts a category-best 22,000 lumens of power, is capable of true linear zoom adjustments in any configuration, and houses a massive toolbox of visual effects. The Proteus Hybrid Max uses the same highly efficient 500 flex lamp as Elation's Proteus Excalibur for the perfect show partner. Check out Proteus Hybrid Max at elationlighting.com. And today's podcast is also brought to you by Mainlight, the partner you trust with the gear you want. Mainlight is a dry hire rental provider, excels in offering superior lighting and stage equipment without competing with its customers. Everything from high intensity lights for large events to precision fixtures for theater and TV film. Mainlight also offers for sale used equipment with a 60-day depot warranty. All equipment is meticulously maintained, tested, and Mainlight owned with no brokerage. With four key locations, Mainlight Tri-State in Teterboro, New Jersey, Mainlight East in Wilmington, Delaware, Mainlight South in Nashville, Tennessee, and Mainlight West in Las Vegas, Nevada, they combine the resources of a national company with the personal touch of a local provider. Mainlight consistently updates its inventory with the latest in lighting technology, truss solutions, and control consoles, including a wide selection of weather-resistant IP65-rated fixtures for outdoor venues. Visit mainlight.com to explore their offerings and connect with representatives across all Mainlight locations, ensuring your event's lighting needs are met with expertise and efficiency. A special mention to Coffee Cult is a partner to Gear Source in that they have created a special Geezers of Gear coffee called Geezers Blend, and I'm sorry, Geezers Grind. Jeez, I can't even remember the name of my own coffee. So it's called Geezers Grind, and it's not only an excellent coffee, but Coffee Cult has been providing all of the proceeds of those sales of Geezers Grind coffee to Roby Backstage, which is a charity for our industry that helps out people in need, fallen soldiers in our industry, etc., and has been very critical in the lives of so many people. So Roby Backstage is an excellent charity. I suggest you support it in other ways, but if all you do is buy this coffee, you're helping, because Coffee Cult is committing their proceeds on the coffee to Roby Backstage for the benefit of our industry. So today is a special day to promote Coffee Cult, because we do have the founder and CEO of Coffee Cult, a longtime friend of mine and also an industry guy, Jamie Martis, on the podcast today. So let's go ahead and say hi to Jamie. Well, hello, Mr. Martis. How are you today?
I'm fine, Marcel. Thanks. How are you?
I'm friggin' unbelievably awesome. I've had two cups of Coffee Cult coffee and I'm zooming. Zoom. I've run out of decaf, so now I'm on full high test Geezer's Grind now. So it's a beautiful blend of dark roast. No, it's what's it called? Roadie something.
Road dog.
Yeah, it's road dog and medium mixed, and goddamn, it's good. But yeah, I'm pretty zippy right now. Two cups is boom.
is that your average, your normal in the morning?
Well,
two cups. Or
so I've gotten to now where, because I've been paying a little bit of attention to this ticker thing that apparently as you get older becomes problematic. And so I've tried to knock it down to two cups of caffeinated coffee per day. And then I'll do one or two cups of decaf. And your decaf actually is the only decaf that I've ever tried that I actually like. So, and I'm not blowing smoke, believe it or not. I would say that even if you weren't on the podcast with me. Your decaf is excellent and drinkable, whereas most taste like decaf. So,
yeah, thanks. A lot of times we'll put it on the cupping table here at the office, and a lot of people can't tell that it is a decaf. So,
yeah. Yeah, once we get to the coffee segment of this podcast, maybe you can tell me why that is. Like, what makes your decaf better than other decaf? Because for me, like, I won't drink decaf normally. It just tastes like shit. You know, I just don't like it. And this one, like, it's funny because I have it in a Lavazza decaf can, or Lavazza decaf can. Because I was using this Lavazza and there was like a quarter of the can left forever because I just hated it. And my girlfriend was drinking it more than I was. And so I'm using it in a Lavazza can. And I could tell when I got down to the bottom of the Coffee Cult coffee and I was starting to dig into the Lavazza because it was mixed in there. And I was like, oh, geez, this is shit. I don't like it. So, yeah, I can definitely tell the difference, but... But now I'm out, so today I had high test coffee and
that's good. Drink it all day. Then you'll crash about 3 o'clock.
Yeah. I don't know. Like, you know, to me, honestly, coffee doesn't have an incredible impact on whether I'm tired or awake or whatever. Like, I can drink coffee right before I go to bed. I can have a double espresso and go to bed and go straight to sleep.
Oh wow.
It's weird. Like when I go to Italy, I'll have, you know, I don't know. You and I went to Italy. I remember one time and like I'll have 10 espressos in a day. No problem. And still sleep.
They're everywhere. You got those little machines. You put your quarters in and it gives you the little cup and away you go.
And it's actually pretty good. It's really pretty good. Yeah. You know, it was funny. I remember when I got my first Nespresso machine and Fausto from Comar visited and stayed at my house. And I said, when we got to the house, I said, you want an espresso? And he said, no, Marcel. And I said, Fausto, come on, do you want to? And he goes, Marcel, I don't want to be offensive, but your coffee is shit. And I said, no, it's actually pretty good. Try one. And he had one and he was blown away. He was like, wow, this kind of tastes like real coffee. This is pretty good. And he's right, though. I mean, you know, like, I'm sure you'll have an espresso after dinner sometimes or something. And it's always so disappointing. It's just it just tastes like shitty, strong coffee. It doesn't even taste like espresso. Like it's not creamy. Like that's one of the things, you know, again, sorry to stay on coffee here, but without being a sales pitch, this is just true. Like one of the things that really my girlfriend and I instantly noticed when we switched to Coffee Cult was it's creamy. Like I use less cream and less sugar than I do with, you know, the pods or whatever, the Keurig coffee and stuff. I use less cream and less sugar. And like it makes that frothy thing at the top with, it's got to do with my machine that I use too, but it's just, I don't know. It's a creamy coffee and it just has a whole different level of flavor and enjoyment to it. So yeah. Unfortunately, though, you're forcing me to, number one, spend $2,000 for another one of these amazing coffee machines in Canada, and secondly, to bring like a suitcase full of Coffee Cult with me when I go up there because you don't ship to Canada. Damn you.
There's some people that we could ship to Canada for. The issue with shipping to Canada is the taxes. For some reason, if you manufacture in Canada, you can ship to the U.S. with no problem, but for us to ship to Canada, there's extra duties and fees, and we don't know what they are until they go there. And then what happens is the customer gets charged for them, and then the customer yells at us. And we don't want a bad customer experience. So
yeah, I can totally understand that
to ship there. But if you needed coffee in Canada, you have my cell phone.
Isn't there like some sort of a co-roaster or something like where you could send the raw beans to somebody in Canada? And it doesn't cost you all those duties and taxes. And then they handle fulfillment for you.
Kind of. So we were going to do that in Europe right before COVID. And COVID came. So it just didn't happen. But If they roast it on our, like our machine,
our
type of machine, we could give them our roast profile and send our coffee to them and they could do that. But even every single machine isn't the same as well.
It's
supposed to transfer, but it's not like a moving light where you can plug it in and you take one moving light and put it in for another moving light.
Just exchange profiles or whatever. I get what you're saying. No, I mean, it's I want to learn more about it on this podcast, but I want to kind of go back into the Wayback Machine a little bit. And, you know, when you and I met, you were a road dog, and you were in our industry. You were living in California. I don't even honestly remember how we met. Maybe you do. I don't know. But
I very specifically remember how we met.
Well, I want to hear about that because I forget. But, you know, it ultimately led to us working together for a number of years and had a great old time. And then you went off and became an entrepreneur and started some really impressive businesses. But how did we meet?
We met. I worked for, I guess it was LSD at the time, Light and Sound Design. And we were here with Shania Twain for a CBS special in Bayfront Park.
And I remember that special with Backstreet Boys too.
Yeah, Backstreet Boys. So, and that's why I wanted to move to South Florida was we were here for that for like 4 weeks in February and the weather was awesome. And we were going to Tobacco Road every night drinking until like 6 in the morning.
And you thought that was Florida, right? Beautiful weather, beautiful women, Tobacco Road, all restaurants and bars are amazing. Yeah. There's no crime.
And high end had a out back, you know, back in the old days, it was, there was a lot of brand loyalty. Like I was a high end guy for the most part, like the Studio Color, Cyber Lights. That was my thing. And then, you had just started at high end and John Wiseman actually, I think helped me or referred me to that job. And then you were down here with him and that's where we met for the first
time. Yeah. I remember I brought my boat over, or I was gonna, maybe I didn't bring it, but I think I was gonna bring it. And then I ended up not bringing it or something. Cause I was going to dock it right there. And I said, "Hey John, let's go do some scuba diving." And he goes, "Yeah, you know, I would, but when I was doing drugs, I loaned out all of my scuba gear to somebody and I can't remember who." So he's lost his scuba gear. He could never find it again. Cause he couldn't remember who he loaned it to.
Cause he was high.
Yeah. But yeah, that was a cool show. I remember that show. I remember, didn't Elton John was there too, because I remember one of the guys in Backstreet Boys got in trouble because he was playing on Elton's piano and it was Elton's real piano that they fly around for him. And, I think that was the same gig, right?
He might've been there. You know, they all kind of blur together after a while, but some of them stick out, but
yeah,
I was touring.
That's actually when I met Shania and couldn't believe how tiny she was. She was like 5 feet tall or something. I was like, "Whoa, you're Shania Twain. Holy shite." She was
pretty
tiny.
Yeah, that was my first experience with Morpheus lights too, back in the day.
Oh, yeah. I forgot you were on that gig. That's where we met. That's true. Yeah. And then
I think they had two extra trailers of lights to service the one trailer of lights on the stage back in the day.
Yeah.
I think they're pretty, from what I understand.
Well, that wasn't just Morpheus. I mean, that was really, that era, you know, the VL small numbers were all pretty unreliable. You know, had all these magical texts that had to follow them around. Obviously the icon from LSD wasn't always that reliable. So that was all that early stuff. You know, it was meant to be handled by their own texts and they could keep it working. And it's kind of like a Harley Davidson, you know, fun to ride, but you always had a tool bag in your back pocket.
Always. Thank goodness. That's how I had a job back then. So.
Yeah. Fixing broken shit. Well, I mean, that's the thing. Like I talk to people about that all the time. Now, all of this imported lighting and wherever it's made, it doesn't even matter whether it's made in Italy or made in China or made in wherever. It's all friggin' good. Like, and I talk to techs and lighting guys all the time now and girls, and I just say, "Do you realize how lucky you are?" Like, I mean, you know, I remember when the rig came down and there was a long list of stuff that needed to be ordered and we'd get the parts order for the next show the next day or whatever. And it just doesn't happen anymore. Like, a story I think I've told before. I went to the Ayrton headquarters in Paris, and I was talking to the engineer, and I was helping put together a deal for a company that was buying a bunch of their product. And so I had to ask some good questions and stuff. And I said, so, you know, if I'm buying a bunch of this stuff, what backup parts do I need? What's the spare parts package that I need? And the engineer looks at me like, and he's got the unit ripped apart. I'm looking at the inside of it, and it's just blowing me away. Like, it's really, really, really impressive guts compared to what we remember, right? And so he's looking at me funny, and he goes, what do you mean? And I said, well, like, let's say I'm on an island somewhere, and I'm not going to have access to any UPS or FedEx, and I need parts to keep these lights working. What do I need? And he goes, I don't know, like, maybe, you know, one of these, maybe one of these. And I said, but what breaks? And he goes, nothing. It just doesn't break, you know, it's pretty reliable. And that's really every light now, like, whether it's Acme or American DJ or Chauvet or high end or any of it, it's all really good stuff now. So
yeah, it's amazing how much the technology has changed. And at the back and when I was young and when I was on the road, it was amazing how where we thought we were like very advanced in technology then, but 20, 25 years later, we look back and are like, man, that was just the beginning.
Yeah. Yeah. No, we were. I mean, we were like, you know, I'm a little older than you. So, you know, I remember the earliest moving lights, and, you know, we were there at sort of the beginning of the industry and saw this stuff advance all the way up. And, you know, I worked for Martin. I learned how to sell broken, silly lights, you know, and knowing that they were going to break. But everything broke, so it was okay. And then high-end kept getting better and better, and it didn't break as much as our stuff, and it was like, oh, boy, now we're in trouble. And so eventually Martin just had to get a lot better at what they were doing and at least be on par with high-end as far as reliability was concerned. But, again, none of that stuff compared to what we have today, and some of that is just down to the LED light source, right?
Sure. Yeah. A lot less heat.
Yeah, yeah.
Problems.
Yeah.
Yeah. Power supply.
Oh. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I mean, so obviously with heat comes all kinds of hazards where you're burning out motors. And, you know, I remember motors where the lubricant was leaking out of them and then they would seize up. And it was just because it was so hot that it was causing the motor to expand and then it was leaking the lubricant out of it. And I'm like, what? Like, why are we dealing with so many weird problems, you know? But yeah, I mean, that it's incredible how far it's gone, and it's not stopping. Like the advancements that these companies are coming up with just blow me away. Every time one of these guys comes out with a new light, it's like, wow. Like it used to be where it was just, we've got one more gobo than the other guys or whatever, right? Or we've got CMY color mixing. They don't, you know. Yeah, our gobos turn, exactly. Our gobos not only turn, but they're indexable. You know, ooh, like now the things that they're doing with this stuff is like unreal, you know. So, yeah, it's all pretty cool.
Do you remember our first trip to Italy, to Comar? I remember being in like some back room with Bruno and this optic table, and he was like, this and this and this. And it was the first I'd ever been exposed to optics like that. And that was, yeah. I think, really cool.
That was some of my favorite moments, was just watching a mad scientist with, you know, just this optics table and just going, I know what I need. I need a PC lens and one of these over here. And he'd just throw all these things together and he'd produce this crazy bright beam on the wall. And you're like, whoa. But in his head, he's like, oh, my God, this has got to be 25,000 lumens or whatever, right? Like, he's just thinking at a different level than we are. But the weird thing with him is he'd put together all of these lenses and stuff. Like, we basically did this with the CF7, you and me. You know, you, me, Fausto, him. We just kind of went, but can't we do this? Can't we do this? And next thing you know, you had the first light that had color mixing and zoom and all of these things. And it was short-lived from a standpoint of being, you know, exclusive. Like, very soon after, there were a lot of other things that were as good or better than the CF7. But it was the first, you know, that did what it did and had what it had. And but, I mean, the guy from this crazy vision and this table that he had, a light came out a couple of months later. It was incredible. And he used carbon fiber so that he could do, like, rapid prototyping, basically. And didn't have to go out and do the, you know, the molds and stuff. So, yeah, that was fun. That was fun.
Now we just 3D print everything.
Yeah, yeah. It's, print it. It's all different now. It's different today for sure. So
is Fausto in charge of Comar still?
No. Fausto hasn't been at Comar for a number of years. Fausto has a really cool business. You should reach out to him sometime. I had him on the podcast, actually. Listen to his podcast. It was pretty fun. But he's got a business where basically he's doing engineering for all kinds of different manufacturers, like dental companies, lighting companies, architectural lighting companies. Like, he just basically, somebody comes to him with an idea and says, we need something to do this. And he designs it and helps get it into manufacturing wherever it's being manufactured, and then moves on to the next project. And he's doing really, really well.
Fausto's good, dude.
Yeah, he's smart, man. He's so smart. I saw him a couple of months ago. I had to go to Italy for some racing business. And I had dinner with Fausto one night and spent a bunch of time with him. It was great. I love that guy.
Oh, cool.
He taught us both so much, didn't he?
Yes.
Yeah.
Like, why do you need so many spare parts, Jamie?
Exactly. Was it you who was with me that time when after the original, like, Comar, Trackman thing all merged under that Stanton Group stuff with Gerard, which you and I believe pretty much hated, and Nick, like, we were all going, why did we do this? Like, what's going on here? We had this beautiful little company and now it's a mess. But was it you and I who were running through the warehouse with flashlights trying to find parts to send to Steve Cohen on one of his tours? Because
I'm sure, yes.
Stanton decided that the warehouse should be closed at whatever it was, like 3 p.m. or something. And we're like, you know, these guys that we're supporting aren't even up by then. Like, you know, we need to be able to ship at 6:00 or 6:30, run something to the airport. And so we were literally running through the airport or through the warehouse with flashlights, finding parts to send to these guys so that they could have them the next morning and not kill us.
Yes.
Yeah. Because Steve Cohen, when he said it needs to be at my hotel tomorrow morning, if it wasn't there, he wasn't a happy guy.
He was super nice. So you wanted to get it there just because.
He was nice until he wasn't.
Well, I never had a bad experience with him. He was always nice.
Well, because I took the brunt of it because, you know, I didn't want it getting down to poor little you. You know, I didn't want you to cry, to go home in tears. You know, I just took the brunt of it and got yelled at by him and Michael Brokaw and anybody else who felt like yelling at me. Sometimes it was Joel Young would call and say, did Steve call you? And I'd be like, yeah, I talked to Steve. Okay, because I want this stuff tomorrow, you know. Get in line.
I can see Joel yelling at you.
Yeah. I mean, it's incredible the stuff that I've had to do to make a living in this industry.
But, so, you know, on their defense, there's big shows and big money and things have to be a certain way.
And I mean, talk about passionate individuals, those guys, right? So we were proud and excited to be on the shows that we were on. Like, we were little old Trackman working out of that upstairs building, you know, you, me, Cynthia, Nick, Adrian and Betsy, right? Yeah. I mean, we were small but fierce. And, you know, I remember at one time we had like Madonna, the Eagles. I don't even remember. We had like 4 or 5 major shows out all at the same time. And I was just like, you know, this is crazy.
Snails, Eagles, yeah. Madonna. I remember being on Eagles and Madonna were in rehearsal at the same time in LA. I was out there for that.
Yeah.
I think, a month in Los Angeles.
Yeah.
After moving there I wanted to get out of there. I was back there for like a month.
Babysitting the CF7s, I think, because I know Cohen was a big fan of CF1200s. He was one of the guys that made that light famous. But the CF7 became so useful so quickly, although, you know, the red flags kind of made its output disappear. But I think we just fixed that.
Just slide them in a little bit.
Yeah. Well, I think what we did is we changed the color red. Like we made them less red, basically. But yeah, I mean, it was a super popular light. It won loads of awards. Remember, we won some LDI awards and Plaza awards and all kinds of stuff. It was a fun period. I think I still have a Backstreet Boys CF7 jacket hanging up in my closet. Yeah, those raincoat things that we had made.
I don't think it fits anymore, but I have one.
I might have a larger size one that I could send to you, or is it smaller that you need? Must be smaller.
No, I think it's bigger. But I remember when we won the award at LDI for the CF7, and I remember being drunk and Bruno being there, and we got the award, and then I knocked the award off the pedestal onto the floor in front of Bruno.
Yeah, not good. No. Not good. No, yeah, that was a really fun period of time. I miss those guys. I miss Bruno. I miss that, just the camaraderie of being sort of the little engine that could, you know, I mean, competing against some behemoth companies and just doing a really great job. So yeah, that was fun. It was a fun period. So after all of that, I think right after that, like, you didn't go to another moving light company or anything, did you? You went and started your own business right after Trackman.
I wanted to have a web hosting company, but I didn't have the funds or the resources or any of that. So, by the way,
sorry to interrupt, but I don't want it to not be said that you were the original web guy for GearSource. You helped build, or you built basically the very first original version of GearSource.com, which at the time was gear-source.com.
Yeah.
And I'll never forget it. I mean, it was that shitty software that you got from England called Actinic. And
is that what it was? I don't even remember what it was.
It was Actinic, and it was horrible, but it worked. I mean, remember, this was 2002. There was no Shopify. There was no nothing. There was no, like, software that you could just go sign up for cloud software and build an e-commerce site or whatever. So, you know, I remember, like, you built it. I think you finished it in, like, maybe end of October, late October. And we got our first order. I remember it was in December, and it was a Martin Wizard. And it was, like, I don't know, $700 or something. I don't remember how much it was. But I just remember the order coming in and saying, you have an order on this Actinic software. And I was like, called you up, and I'm like, Jimmy, what do I do? What do I do with this software? I don't know what to do. And you know, you said, well, I don't know either, you know, like, let's figure it out. And so I figured out how to get the order from there into QuickBooks and to actually satisfy the order. It was crazy. It was fun times. Again, it's, you know, those early stages in businesses that are so much fun.
Right. Yeah. That was fun creating something new. I mean, no one was really doing that then.
No.
And that's what I wanted to do after I left the lighting world. So yeah, it worked out pretty good. But I found myself back in the lighting world somehow.
Yeah.
I didn't know really anything that's how to start a web hosting business or any of that. So yeah, I was a lighting guy since I was younger. Yeah. So
yeah, I mean, it lures you back. It's part lifestyle, part just what you know. You know, like, you've got a comfort level and confidence or whatever in that world. Whereas you go into this IT world and it's like, whoa, there's all these nerdy people from different countries and stuff. Like, I don't know what I'm doing as much as they do, maybe. I don't know. But
with degrees, they have degrees and college education and things like that. And
super, I was just friggin' smart. Yeah. I mean, you were smart too. Like, you were the only guy I knew who knew how to build a website. So, you know, boom, I went to you. And I think you charged me like $2,000 or something. It wasn't a very large sum of money. And I remember we got in a fight over something, because I remember arguing with your dad. Your dad actually called me and said, you know, you rah, rah, rah. And I got in trouble from your dad over something.
I think a lot of that was my mistake, because my dad found that software. And then what happened was, I was at Disney and something happened and I couldn't deal with it. So then you called Ackerman, the software company, and then they called my dad because my dad was involved with it. So,
Sold me a dodgy license is what you did.
No, I didn't even tell you the license. We were using it. So
piracy. We were pirating software.
Not really. No, it was our license. It was our license and we were using it. It was just, it wasn't a piracy thing, but
they thought it was.
We didn't know you. So they're like, well, who's that guy and why is he?
I see.
Saying, yeah, we don't know.
I don't know why I remember, but I remember getting yelled at by your dad. And I was like, what the heck is going on here?
My dad doesn't yell either. So that's crazy.
Yeah.
He was pretty calm.
He was passionate. Well, probably because they probably accused him of doing something bad, you know, and he probably didn't like it very much or whatever. But anyways, what was that first business that you went back and started back in the lighting business?
I went back to the cruise ships. So at Trackman, since we were in South Florida,
yeah,
I met people from the cruise ships. So I needed to make some money while my web thing was going. So I started working for Lightspeed. Pete, who is it? Pete?
Peter Moore,
Peter Moore. So
I forgot all about that. I forgot you worked with Peter.
And then so I met some other cruise ship people and I was working for them on another cruise line. And they said if somebody had a business in South Florida that had that service cruise ships, we would use them all the time. And I was like, okay, well then I should go start a business so I can have this person as a customer. That company, that cruise line never hired me ever. But fortunately, the company Peter Moore was contracting out hired me, which was, he was pissed about, I'm sure, but
yeah,
it wasn't even on purpose. But I needed to work. So I was like, okay, I'll go work for you guys.
Yeah.
Turned into craziness.
Yeah.
Traveling the world. I had six sets of tools somewhere in the world that all in motion to go to a cruise ship somewhere for a dry dock.
What was that company called? Sidram?
That was Sidram Services.
Yeah. And Sidram, of course, is your last name backwards.
Yeah, it's my last name backwards. So it's Sidram Services. And then that was great for a while. The cruise ship business was really good. They had a lot of high-end and Martin equipment, which I knew how to fix. So I did a lot of repairs. I did a training for them on Whole Hog, on Hog PC. They had a lot in their lounges at the time. And then that was great until my son was born. And I came home one day and my son was like, who are you? So I told my wife that I want to stay home. So I started a generator company. I figured I could be everyone's friend, the sound guys, the lighting guys. I didn't have to worry about fighting with
everyone except Ron. Everyone's friend except Ron.
I'm friends with everyone but Ron anyway. So
I remember getting that phone call from Ron going, what the hell is this guy doing? You know, he's trying to take all my customers and my staff and what the hell is he doing? And I remember calling you up and saying, hey, you must be doing something right. Ron's pissed. So you took a lot of business quickly. And I mean, it was, I don't think it was from, and hopefully Ron's listening to this, but I don't think it was from any deceptive practices unruly practices or, you know, unscrupulous things that you were doing. It was hustle. It was sheer hustle. You were just out working them.
It was hustle. And plus I was a technician, you know, I was a road guy. So I understood what the shows needed and I only did entertainment power. And so I understood, like, I knew what they needed for their stages. I knew what they expected. I knew they expect if someone called, like with Steve Cohen, wanting parts on his desk the next day, that's how it is. So
yeah,
I came from that background. So I bonded with those customers fairly easily because I knew what was expected. So that's how we gained a large customer base quick. I had 44 generators.
Yeah. You grew that business so quickly. And that again was called Sidram Power, right?
That was Sidram Power, correct.
Yeah. And what did you end up selling that company or you just divested or what, how did that go away?
That company, I still have a warehouse of gear actually.
Oh, so, really?
Yeah. I still have, I got tons of 4-aught cable ramps. Distro box.
We need one to of my buddies texted
me yesterday about I'll miss it if I sell it. But I talked to my wife the other day about it. I was like, I think I'm going to want to start doing that again. She's like, no, you don't.
Yeah. Yeah.
You She's know, like, I don't want to start doing that.
It's just like, you know, growing your hair back again. You go to your barber or hairstylist or whatever and go, I think I want to grow my hair long again. And they go, no, you don't. No. You know, you have this beautiful vision of the future with flowing, beautiful locks of hair.
It right.
Like that. It's just not, it's no. going to grow in gray and nasty and nah, you don't want to do that.
Well, so. I also thought that I had this great idea of going and doing a gig with one of my buddies. I still have a lot of friends in the entertainment business. And I was like, I'll just see if I can go be a tech for someone or moving light tech or something, go hang some lights. And then I started looking at their Facebook pages and their social media. I was like, all these events start after I'm in bed. I don't think I'm
That's so funny. It's so true though, too. You know, it's like, I have to go to the Panthers hockey game tonight because my buddy Randy, I don't know if you remember Randy, but he's constantly bugging me to go to the hockey games, and he's got season tickets and he always gets these extra tickets and he's like, Marcel, go. And it used to be really fun when I lived 10 minutes away. Now I live an hour away and I'm like, oh God, the game doesn't end till like 10 o'clock. And by the time I get home, it's like 11:15 or something. It's just not worth it. You know, it's
right. Parking used to be free at Panthers.
It's $40 now to park at a game that you're paying all this money for tickets for, which I'm not paying for the tickets, but $40 to park. And it used to be free. You're right. I hate that. Did you ever go to a game with me when I had the parking underneath the building?
I did, yes.
Because that was whoop ass, where you just, there's pull like in. 50 parking spots down there or something. You pull right under the building. They check you for bombs and stuff with their mirrors. And you pull under the building straight to the elevators up to your seats. Boom. It's like being a rock star.
That was the good old days. You had good. I had season tickets later on a few years ago. And mine were on the glass, but yours were up a little bit higher above the glass line. And I like those.
Yeah, on the glass, you can't really. I mean, you can see the look on their face as they're getting punched right in front of you, but you can't see the goal that's scored on the other end of the ice or whatever, right?
Correct, right. And we were on the ref side or the bad box side, the penalty side.
Yeah.
Sometimes it was hard to see through the penalty box.
Yeah.
For sure.
Yeah.
But I love hockey.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I'm biased, of course, because I'm Canadian, but I still think it's the best live sport. You know, most sports I prefer to watch on television. Hockey is not one of those. You know,
I don't like hockey on TV in person.
I like it on TV, but I love it live. It's an incredible live sport. So I have to stay up past my bedtime tonight and go to a hockey game. So I get what you're saying. I remember my ex-wife, Barb, one time she had a show with, it was either Crystal Method or Chemical Brothers. And it was during, Music Week or whatever it's called. And she goes, do you want to go see them? And I go, yeah, that'd be fun. I'll go see them. You know, I probably know the designer or whatever. And I said, yeah, I'll go see them with you. And she goes, okay, they go on at, I think it was like 12:30 or 1 or something. And I'm like, hell no. They go on at 1 o'clock in the morning. No, I'm not going to that. Yeah.
I mean, yeah, that's how it was.
Yeah. Yeah.
Do you know Lawrence Upton?
Yeah, of course. Yeah.
I worked for him.
Wow. Yeah. Man, crazy dude. Crazy
Lawrence,
dude.
Lawrence, you're out there. Find me. Call me. Lawrence is crazy. I had a great time with Lawrence.
I've got his number if you need it.
Yeah, I would love to talk to him.
Well, if it's still the same. I haven't talked to him in a couple of years, but if it's still the same number, I've got it. I don't remember if he ended up coming on the podcast or not. We were talking about him coming on, and then I don't remember if he actually did or not. I think he did. I think I've got a podcast with Laz Upton.
The best tour I ever did was with Lawrence.
Really?
Small bus tour. My Life with the Thrill Kill Cult. They were that just a small industrial goth band, and one bus and a trailer. Those are the most fun tours.
Yeah,
for sure.
Yeah, he's a wild man. I mean, and some of the things that, like, you know, when we were talking about him coming on the podcast, we'd go off into the weeds on some really crazy stories, and it's like, whoa, you know, like he follows some wild stuff. He's is it Laz who's a big like World War II.
Yes.
Buff. Yeah, he's really, really into that stuff.
He's English, so he's...
Yeah.
I always thought every person from England was like Lord, was lost because...
Yeah.
He'd say something and he'd start telling you about World War II.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's... That's him.
Yeah, great. He's really into that stuff. And he wanted to talk to me about it. And I don't have any knowledge. You know, I know like the two or three movies I've seen or whatever, but that's about it, right? I'm out. I'm done. That's it. That's all I know.
Super artistic, super creative.
Yeah. Like, yeah, brilliant guy.
That tour was a low budget tour. And I think we had maybe six, what were they? Color studios. And in order to get more out of them, he put mirrors on the back of the stages, but like reflective.
Oh,
like,
cool.
And it just filled the whole
looked
stage
like
up.
Twice as many lights.
Yeah, it's just very smart guy.
Yeah, well, and some of the stuff he did with Crystal Method was fun as hell too. Like, you know, I love some of that stuff. Like, at the end of the day, they're DJs, right? And
yes.
I think he was one of the early sort of EDM pioneers of lighting design, you know, because DJs didn't really get a lot of lights back then. And here's a guy touring as LD for a DJ or whatever. And it's like, whoa, that's weird.
That data flash wall was
breaking. What?
I mean, that data flash wall was like, that
was very cool. Yeah.
Technology.
Yeah.
I think like a stack of four LCD controllers.
Yeah.
That were custom programmed for him for that.
Yeah.
That was a Brad Chiller thing too.
So, yeah. Yeah. No, that was really, really cool. High End did some cool stuff like that. Like that was, you know, obviously Richard behind most of that stuff because Richard loved the music, loved the people behind the music, and that was his vibe, right? And I think that's what went missing sort of in the whole High End thing was the less and less Richard became involved, the more corporate and boring it became.
Right. It was awesome. I remember my first trip to High End and I met Craig Burroughs and his wife at the I think it was Liz at the time.
Yeah.
And I met them and we had so much fun in Austin and the factory was so cool. I remember their swag room was like the size of my entire coffee cult.
Yeah. The warehouse. Swag room was fun.
They had so much swag. I'd never seen
so
much swag anywhere. And that was really cool. They really put out and tried to teach the technicians and the LDs and the board program and the programmers and stuff like that. They were very good at getting their brand across.
Yeah. Yeah. No, they did an amazing job. High End did an incredible job. They were, you know, as a smaller and more eager competitor, I always looked up to them huge, you know, and I remember when I went to work for them, it was so weird because I was the Hatfields joining the McCoys, you know? And so when they brought me into that swag room, take whatever you want. I was like, I can't wear high end stuff. You know, like it just didn't feel right. You know, it felt really weird, like putting on high end stuff after, you know, working so hard to try and beat them for 10 years or whatever.
But I learned to negotiate from John Wiseman when he was there.
Yeah, that's a good person to learn to negotiate from. He's one of the best.
He's one of the best. John Wiseman's pretty. So it was him, and then I came out to work for you. So then I had to learn how to be nice. So John used to tell people he's cutting them off, like you're not getting any lights unless you do as I say. And then I come out to track them, and everybody's it was a totally different vibe.
Yeah, because that's the position that we were always in, you know, like starting with Martin, you know, we had to kiss a lot of ass to get things done. We couldn't demand anything. You know, I mean, it wasn't that sort of a situation. We were in a distant number two or three or four position. We weren't, you know, the leaders who could threaten people and stuff.
I think I got on John's ass once when I was at Trackman about something and he got mad about it. And I started laughing, telling him he didn't like his own medicine. But I learned a lot from John, and I didn't work for them. Their office was by my house. So I used to, if I wasn't working or brokered on a gig, I would go over there and program or do something.
Oh, the LA High End office, you mean?
The office.
That was, where was that? Burbank?
Van Nuys area.
Van Nuys, right. Yeah. Yeah. Is that where you grew up?
I lived in LA for a long time. Yeah. For the most part, I grew up in LA.
Where were you born?
Illinois. Oh, Peoria. Okay. A Caterpillar tractor.
I didn't even know that.
Yeah.
What else is in Peoria? Oh, nothing. No. I was thinking, I was thinking the jail from Blues Brothers, but that's in Joliet.
Yeah, that's a little bit, away from there, but.
That's where World Music Theater is too, or whatever it's called today, but the shed.
Is it? Yeah.
In Joliet. Yeah. Yeah. I went to a bunch of shows there in like the early '90s. It's fun.
Yeah. And then, so that was good. I left and did generators and power, and somehow I wound up in coffee. I did staging for a while. So the casino, the Seminoles, the local casino here, we're doing power for, and my daughter was dancing at the time. So I bought some staging from her or for her, and they found out I had staging, and they're like, we want to rent your stage. I'm like, no, I don't want to do staging, as I owned staging before and I didn't care for it.
Heavy, I think I got another call from Ron right about then, by the way. What is this guy doing? He's just copying everything I do. And I said, maybe he's just doing business, buddy.
That was it. People asked me for stuff. I don't think he was in the staging business really then. But a lot of people, you know, our business is really is very, very competitive.
It is. Yeah. It's a very competitive industry. Everybody's friends until you're bidding against each other. And then it's like, you know, lose my number.
As long as you're helping them, giving them something for free, they're your buddy.
Yeah. So as I understand it, the coffee story is basically that it started as a hobby where you just basically wanted better coffee and you learned a little bit about it. And I know how you operate. Like you're a little bit like me, but even worse, where you don't do anything halfway. Like if you decide you're going to do something, you're like, I'm going all the way in, balls like deep.
I was like, and I bought station because I thought I wasn't getting generator gigs.
Yeah.
So Sino wanted to rent stages. And then I bought a mobile stage because I thought I wasn't getting these jobs, but kind of find out that wasn't the case. The jobs weren't happening or whatever. So anyway, I wound up in the staging business. And then since I was doing so much, I needed better coffee because coffee and
you weren't sleeping.
Yeah, I know there was, all I did was work. So I bought a coffee roaster, like everything that I do. I was like, I didn't buy a small coffee roaster. I bought a 12 kilo roaster. So I had to roast, the minimum I could roast it that was 11 pounds.
But hang on a sec. So were you like a big coffee drinker? Like you loved coffee and it was just a passion and... So you were reading like coffee magazines and stuff about where the best beans come from and all that kind of stuff. Is that sort of part of it?
Well, when I was a kid in Los Angeles, a guy that I knew had a coffee shop called Cafe Mocha on Melrose, which was down the street from my house. And he sold his half to his partners because he was doing some internet thing. And we were like, oh, you're not cool. You're not doing coffee anymore. You're doing the internet thing. And that person, actually, his name's Sky Dayton. He was the founder of Earthlink. So he actually sold his coffee shop to go start Earthlink. And we were like,
probably not a bad idea. yeah. Okay.
I should have gone with him. But so I've been I liked coffee for a long, 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 long time. So I just had the means in a warehouse and I was like, I need better coffee. It sucks here. And I bought a Jura at the time. Do you have a Jura yet, espresso machine?
No, the one I have is DeLonghi. It's a DeLonghi automatic thing that does, it grinds the beans and does all of the different stuff.
Yeah, the Jura is very similar. So I had a Jura and I was drinking coffee out of a can that was beans. And I was like, oh, this is good, but I wonder if I can find something better. And that's how it started. So... I had to roast 11 pounds of coffee. So all of my delivery trucks for Sidram, either staging or generators, had coffee and we're giving them out to our customers.
Oh, that's cool.
Is how it started. And
that's cool. Very organic. Very organic way to build a customer base. Just to start handing it out for free.
And it was called Center Stage Coffee because I was like, well, I don't know what to call it. It's whatever. It's going to be Center Stage Coffee. And so we were giving it out, and then people started asking for it if it wasn't on the trucks. I said, can we have coffee? And we're like, well, we don't have any, but I'll bring you some next time. I promise. They're like, no, I'll buy it from you. I want the coffee.
Yeah.
So that's how we wound up selling coffee. It was not for any other reason of people wouldn't leave us alone.
Yeah.
On how they wanted the coffee, which was cool. We were making something that was awesome.
So you just left your office, went into the warehouse, started roasting coffee on your own and probably bagging it on your own, shipping it on your own, doing everything on your own. Because you couldn't afford an employee to do it yet. Well, not out of the coffee business anyways.
No, we wasn't anywhere near anything like that. It was, I would roast it and put it in the bag. And basically, I'd go roast what I wanted to drink myself. So I would go roast it. And then whatever extra would go in the pile for the other customers.
Yeah. So by the time you were actually selling it and taking orders, was it still called Center Stage Coffee?
So what my mother convinced me that I needed to sell coffee on Amazon. And I was like, I don't want to sell coffee because I want to go do staging. I want to go make $100,000 on the weekend. I don't want to go chase $2 to $3 for a bag of coffee.
Yeah.
I mean, are you fucking kidding me? Yeah. I go work like 3 days a week and go make a bunch of money, or I could go chase a couple bucks for a coffee. She's like, oh, you have to do this. So she bugged me so much that I was like, fine, whatever. I'll sell coffee.
Why was she so interested in you doing coffee?
She liked that I was doing coffee, and she sold things on Amazon. So she knew where she knew good items to sell on Amazon at the time. Things have changed a lot. Obviously.
Yeah.
That was like 12 years ago. So she just pressured me into it, which, you know, okay, that's good. Thank you, Mom. But, I shipped some coffee to Amazon, and I was like, I don't want anything to spoil my Center Stage Coffee name, because I got a good thing going. So let's call it something else. And I'm like, well, when I give the people this coffee, they won't go away. Like, even if I want them to go away, they keep asking me for it. So it's clearly our own cult. So
yeah.
So then I was like, oh, we'll call it Coffee Cult. And then the C's were Coffee Cult with C, domain was taken. So I was like, oh, well, German, it's in K. So we'll make it Coffee Cult with K's. And everyone's going to be like, what is that? So that's how I wound up being Coffee Cult with K's.
That's and awesome.
Now we own the domain for both. We own the C.
Oh, do you really? You own the C one as well?
Yes.
Oh, that's cool. Have you ever thought about changing it?
No.
To C's? No.
Uh-uh. No, because it's an established brand. So.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's just every time I'm reading the promo for Coffee Cult on the podcast, I always say Coffee Cult, coffee with a K, cult with a K, you know?
Yeah. But you can.
Otherwise, I'm afraid they won't find your website.
Yeah, they'll find it. If you look up Coffee Cult anyway, in any which way, you should find us.
What happened to the other company? They just went away finally?
So it was someone sitting on a domain. It was
those bastards.
Whatever. They tried to actually. So the funny part is they tried to sell it to me for like $20,000.
Yeah.
I was like, fuck off. So, yeah. No, we're not doing that. And then for a while, somehow it came and I bought it for $1,000.
Oh, wow. Did I ever tell you the GearSource domain story?
No.
GearSource.com? Because remember, it was gear-source.com. And it was GearSource, like if you went on, who is or whatever, like who owns the domain. If you went on that, it was owned by some Cisco reseller who was defunct. They were out of business. And I had reached out to the guy and never got a response back. So I just said, screw it, we'll go with the hyphen, which, knowing what I know now, was the craziest, dumbest, stupidest idea ever, like putting a hyphen in a domain name. But so we were probably a year in to GearSource, and I get an email from a guy saying, hey, I'm whatever, Bob, and I own this domain. It's no longer a business anymore. Would you like to buy it from me? And I go, well, you know, me being a sales guy, well, you know, I don't know. Like, we've really got our customers used to the hyphen now, so I don't think it really has any value to me. And he goes, well, look, I only want $10,000 for it. And I go, yeah, that's just not going to happen. And he goes, how about $5,000? I said, look, you know, the domain is beautiful. Obviously, I'd like to own it, but we're a startup company. I don't have $5,000 to throw around for a domain, and my customers are already used to the hyphen. And he goes, well, let me think about it. So he sends me an email a few days later and he goes, do you sell those smoke machine things? And I said, yeah, we do. And he said, how much are they? And I said, well, you know, a good one's probably about $1,000. And he goes, will you trade me for one of those? And I said, sure. So I traded him like some Martin smoke machine or something for, I think it was a gym machine actually, for the domain. And I got the domain. That's, so it probably cost awesome. Me $400 or $500 or something, I think, at the end of the day. And I got the domain.
And you sold him Fluid for the next 10 years.
No, actually never heard from him again, but whatever. I have the domain. And so, yeah. LED Source, though, when I started that, that was a similar thing where they wanted like $20,000 for it or something. And I think I ended up paying $3,000. So, yeah. I mean, those are crazy businesses that make their money off collecting domains, I guess. I don't know. I own a bunch of domains. I bought domains like real estate in the early days. I probably have 200 domains or something. And every once in a while, I'll get an email or a call from somebody saying, hey, I'd really like that domain. And I give them a reasonable price for it, $1,000 or something, and they usually go away. So someday I'll have to start letting them go.
$1,000 for a domain. Yeah.
Yeah. So
I have a lot of domains.
Yeah. Back to the early days of Coffee Cult or Center Stage. So the first beans that you bought, were you just buying them locally from like some bean wholesaler, or how did that happen?
I bought them for a bean wholesaler, but they were not local. They were in Rhode Island, I think, something.
Okay. Up. And so did you research or did you just buy whatever they told you to buy?
So I did a little research. They told me what was good. I actually hired someone to teach me how to roast coffee. Yeah. Originally, which was cool. I learned from them, and then I learned I wanted better. So then I spent a lot of time in Seattle and Portland learning from some roasters out there.
That's sort of like the American mecca of coffee, right? That Northwest area, Portland and Seattle.
It used to be. It's spread through the U.S. now, but back then that was
it.
And I learned to roast coffee on the machine I bought. It's nothing like we have now. We still have it. I still have it, but it was all manual, no automation. So you'd be bagging coffee, and if you forgot to do something on the machine when it was roasting, the coffee would totally turn out wrong.
Oh wow!
So that was a pretty cool experience, but I wanted better coffee, and you had to go out there. You couldn't go to YouTube and learn how to roast coffee.
Yeah.
Back now, I think you can go to YouTube and learn anything.
Pretty much. Yeah. Yeah. No, and I've always followed you on social media and stuff, so I know that, you know, you've made many, many trips to different regions of the world, and you've gone to farms and or whatever they're called, is it called a farm where they grow coffee? Yeah. Mm-hmm. You've gone to all these different farms, and so I would guess now you're kind of an expert in beanology or whatever it's called, right?
I would hope so. I know I've learned a lot, and I know quite a bit. There's people that know way more than me. I learned about roots of coffee plants, of what the roots need to look like when you plant them. I'm like, man, I just want to know if the coffee tastes good. But it's crazy. They'll start a seedling, and then they'll take it out of the dirt, and they'll inspect all the roots before they plant it in the fields to make sure the roots are large enough and sustainable, because they want to plant a tree for 20 years. They don't want to plant it for a couple of years.
Yeah.
Pretty cool stuff. And the altitude and the microclimates of different regions,
for
coffees.
I read about, which one was it that I read about? Sumatra, I think it was. And, cause I didn't know that that was actually a place. And, so I went and read about why the coffee there, where is that? That's in Jakarta or something, isn't it?
Indonesia.
Yeah. Or near Jakarta in Indonesia. And you know, just like why it's good and the just strange mix of weather components that make the coffee so good. And, you know, it's pretty wild. There's a lot to it.
Yeah. They have their own, processing that they do there as well. Nowhere else does as wet hauling. So
what's that mean?
It's how they take the pulp off of the cherry off of the seed, after the coffee's picked from the plant.
Oh, okay.
They have their own special process.
So coffee's picked from a plant, and then what is it? What's that look like? It doesn't look like a bean, right? It looks like a cherry.
looks like a cherry. It looks like a fruit cherry. You can eat them, just don't eat the beans in the middle. Huh. The bean, the seed is actually the coffee part that we use as coffee.
Interesting. I didn't know that.
A whole cherry outside layer and a pulp inside.
So is it actually called a cherry, a coffee cherry, or just a cherry?
Cherries, coffee cherry. Huh. Coffee tree. Coffee
Interesting.
Cherry.
Interesting. Yeah. And does it taste like a cherry?
They're sweet. The better the coffee, the sweeter the coffee, the better it is, the sweeter it will be. They all taste different. There's different varieties of coffee. There's yellow. There's a bazillion. So geisha is like the original coffee bean. I just bought a geisha for a crazy amount of money in Colombia.
Yeah, I saw that on social, on Coffee Called Cider or something. I saw it.
Yellow bourbon, and then there's all kinds. There's all varieties of coffee.
Yeah.
Which contribute to the taste.
So what's your favorite? Probably depends what day it is, right?
Yeah, what time of the day it is, and what we're roasting, and what season it is. So there's lots of great coffees.
Yeah. Well, I know you were really hyped on this Jamaican one, and you sent me a bag of it, and I didn't like it. Like, it just had a funky flavor to it that, to me, I'm just so in love with my regular daily cup of coffee that I get right now. Where are my beans from? The Road Dog and the Medium.
Colombian and Guat. Colombian, Guat, and Brazil is in that blend.
Oh, really? Huh. Interesting.
When those are great coffees, those are very, very good coffees. Blends are very good. The single origins is where you get to see a lot of different things in coffee.
Yeah.
So we look for acidity and sweetness and complexity in coffee. So that's not for everyone. So some people don't like a fruity coffee, but that fruity coffee, you don't necessarily want to drink with milk.
Yeah. Either, so. Yeah. Well, I'll tell you, I had tried a few of yours. Like, I tried the dark roast. I think I tried the Road Dog. I don't think I ever tried medium by. Oh, I did try medium by itself. And that's when I basically started mixing half a bag of medium with half a bag of Road Dog and going, okay, now we're on to something. Because the Road Dog, I didn't mind. I liked it. But my girlfriend, it was just too strong. Like, she was normally a pretty, like, a blonde coffee drinker, you know? And, because she's British and she drinks tea. She wasn't even a coffee drinker before I really convinced her to be one. And, but when I did that mix, it was really good. And I remember, I think I was talking to you on the phone or something, and I said, hey, I finally found the perfect coffee. I'm mixing your medium and your Road Dog. And you said, well, we could make a blend for you. And, that's when we came up with the whole Geezer's Grind thing and started to do that. So.
If she likes, she'll like the geisha. The geisha is more tea-like.
Is it really?
Yeah, I'll send you some.
Yeah, I'll have to check that out. I got to make another order anyways because I got to get some decaf.
You know what decaf coffee is, right?
Tell me.
It's like a hooker that just wants to cuddle.
That's good. That's really good.
People are like, oh, my God, I can't believe that guy said that. I'm like, man. Used to see the other stuff that comes out of my mouth when I'm not.
I've known you. I remember funny story when we worked together. This was sort of pre-social media and pre all of that stuff. This was what, like 2000 or something, 1999, 2000. I don't know. But I remember you sent like a really nasty, dirty, some kind of wicked porn thing or something to Adrian in the office, and you accidentally sent it to Adrian Gurman, who at the time worked for LDI or Lighting and Sound America or whatever it's called. And and she sends me a message going, is this Jamie who works for you? And I said, yeah, that's Jamie. And she goes, I wonder if he meant to send this to me. And I'm like, nope, I'm pretty sure he didn't.
Wrong Adrian.
Wrong Adrian.
We were a little wild back then. We were young and wild. And I remember our first trip to Italy, I was to Comar, the staff, because back in the day, and things have changed now, but it was, you know, let's go hang out at the gentleman's club. So we went to Italy. I was like, hey, who wants to go to the gentleman's club? And they all looked at me like, why would we go there? The brothel's down the street. I was like, oh,
it's true. Yeah, it's true.
It was wild back in those days. It was really like the movies.
Did you went over to the Rimini show, right? At some point, did you? No, you never went to the Rimini show? Because there was a famous, it wasn't even a gentleman's club. It was just some weird place where you went and these beautiful women from Eastern Europe would sit next to you on the couch and talk to you and tell you how beautiful you are and how amazing you are and stuff. And then if you were brave enough, you wheeled them out of there and took them back to your hotel and you just paid whatever the fee was to the club. It was called Lady Godiva. And, you know, I never partook, but I've been there a bunch of times, but I just, you know, wasn't interested in the end game that they had going on there. But several people did, and I won't mention any names, but one guy in particular who worked for me at the time, was talking to this girl, and he's like, she went to the bathroom or something, and he goes, Marcel, she's like the most beautiful girl ever. I've never seen an Italian woman as beautiful as her. And I go, because she's probably not Italian. And he goes, oh, no, she's Italian. Her name is like Victoria or something. And I go, no, you know what? She might be telling you a fib. And he goes, no, she's Italian, and she's the most beautiful girl I've ever seen. And so he leaves with her. And he goes, you know, I'm taking this beautiful Italian girl back to my hotel. And I'm like, hey, good for you. Have fun. And so I call the manager over and I go, hey, that girl that just left with my buddy. And he goes, Victoria. And I go, yeah, is she Italian? And he goes, fuck no. She's from Uzbekistan. I laughed my ass off. I remember at breakfast in the morning, I was like, hey, how was that Uzbekistanian? No, she's Italian. And I'm like, no, buddy. No, she ain't Italian. So, yeah.
No way.
I've got stories. Some of those you can't tell, though, or at least you can't attach them to people.
Right. Now, we had a good time, though, and that was an amazing time.
It was fun. So what are some of the biggest things you've learned being in the coffee business, like challenges or things that if you knew then what you know now, you might have gone a different direction or, you know, bumps
coffee
on the head?
Yeah, I want to change it for anything. The one thing I like about coffee, and although I have to chase $2 or $3 for a bag of coffee for a profit, in staging, yeah, I made generators, I made a lot of money, but if one of my staff left a pen out of a stage, it would fall down and kill a bunch of people. I don't have to worry about that in coffee. So yeah, that's what I really like about
coffee. Unless you accidentally, you know, put poison into the bags or something, and you're killing all your drinkers.
And the other thing about coffee that is really surprising and entertainment is I have a lot of, I have two robot arms here that we use in manufacturing and quite a bit of automation, since I come from an lighting automation background.
Yeah.
And the technology in the staging world is so much more advanced than the rest of the industrial world that when you're in entertainment, you don't understand. Entertainment is actually pushing the envelope all the time on technology.
Yeah.
Like our roasters have touchscreen panels on them.
Yeah.
And, they run to run our, and it's that they're little computers, but they're just so not responsive compared to a lighting console.
Yeah. Yeah.
When I'm like, this sucks. When I was buying, and they're big bucks too. So when I was buying, I was pushing the buttons, I was playing with it, I was like, is this your standard panel? They're like, that's the new latest and greatest panel that you can get. I'm like, no, it's not. I'm like, give me a panel.
I'll tell you what, that's where you connect with Fausto. That's where you connect with Fausto and you go, hey, Fausto, can you make a better panel? And give it to him and he'll come back to you 2 months later with a complete design for a better panel and the software and everything all done. And then you go out and sell the product, you know? As a side hustle, but I agree with you. Like when you take some of the things that you've learned and seen in our industry and you take it back to a different industry, it's like, wow, you know, like just technology at a completely different level, and also urgency and timing and all kinds of other stuff that right. other industries, like the urgency of the entertainment business compared to, like, when I had LED Source, for example, and our customers were, you know, architectural or commercial lighting opportunities, warehouses and buildings and things like that, there was no urgency. Like, you know, when can you get it done? March. Okay, that's perfect. Yeah, as long as we can get it done by July, we're good. You know, okay, you know, that's easy. Like, I could take three vacations between now and then.
A lot of those things, urgency, getting things right the first time, and the technology is really, from the entertainment business, really helped me with Coffee Cult.
Yeah.
Because most companies don't have that. They're like, okay, we got an order. That's nice. We'll get it out. And we're like, as fast as we can get that order out, it's going to go out. And I remember I went to go, I wound up Robot Arms. They're on our YouTube channel, but I wound up the Robot Arm. I was looking for a nitrogen generator, and I went to a trade show and they had all these robot arms over. And I was like, what are these things? They're super cool. And I need one. And I went home and I did all the online training for the class. And the next day I went in and I said, can I play with that? They're like, yeah, sure. I went and I programmed and had it running around. They're like, how did you learn that? I said, I just did it. I did it a lot. I looked at it last night.
That's hilarious.
Oh, that's like super complicated. I'm like, no, dude, this is like LCD controller style. From
Yeah. This is 1980s.
Yeah. So bringing over that technology really helped with coffee, and coffee business is really cool too. It's a lot different than entertainment. You take 10 staging owners, and you put them in a room to drink beer together, and one walks out because he killed the rest of them. And then coffee, you put 5 people in a room to drink beer together, and they recruit 5 other people to come and drink beer.
That's awesome. It's a community.
Yeah, it's a totally different industry until you get to a certain level. Then when you start getting a little bit bigger, it gets a little bit more competitive, but...
Is there ever an internal fight or debate or discussion on the retail versus the retail store? Because I know you have a coffee shop, which is pictured in the background here on the podcast. But is that something you're looking to expand? And is there discussions of expanding that versus discussions of shutting it down and just being a brand and shipping out to your customers?
So, my son is, and he'll graduate his undergrad this year, and he does his master's next year, and then he will get to decide what direction he'd like to go. I already know what direction he's going to go. I'm just going to let him decide it.
Yeah.
But I think he's going to probably head up more of a retail division.
Yeah.
Possibly, and then also run the wholesale, the branding. As well,
yeah.
You might see that from us in the near future.
I know quite a bit about franchising. If you ever want to have a conversation just about growing the business via franchise, I can save you a whole bunch of money just by giving you a lot of stuff for free that somebody's going to charge you a couple hundred thousand dollars for as a consultant. There's good and bad in franchising, and there's good and bad in doing it yourself and having company-owned stores. And so, you know, if you're going to expand, there's sort of kind of two paths that are entirely different but similar, and both have benefits and both have some shitty stuff. I think based on who Coffee Cult is and what you do, franchising might actually be a good option for you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We'll look at that coming up because I'm ready to retire and smoke cigars and drive my tractor.
Well, that sounds fun. That's what old people do, is they buy tractors. I have a very good friend in racing who's in England, and he buys all these old John Deere tractors and then resells them every once in a while and stuff. And he's just got this big farm full of tractors.
Yeah, that's it. So farming is my new thing lately. So I got corn and potatoes and blueberries.
Where?
And bees. And hour north of Tampa in Florida.
So is that where you live now, or is that just where the farm is?
No, I'm out in Davie. I'm out by the camels in Davie now.
Oh, okay. Camels.
Yeah. We have camels. I see them when I drive to work in the mornings.
Oh, that's wild.
Camels, of all things. Yes.
That's crazy.
when, and they take them out on the weekend so the kids can come and feed them and donate to their nonprofit and stuff. So generally, if I tell someone I live by the camels, they'll be like, oh, okay, I know where that is.
It's funny because I know somebody up here in Wellington who has camels. So, you know, weird. But I mean, in Wellington, it's fairly normal because there's a lot of farms up here, you know, for polo and all of these different horse sports that happen in Wellington. But I remember you were like a big Hollywood guy, Hollywood, Florida guy, and getting involved in local politics and all kinds of stuff. I guess you've gotten over that illness.
Trying to. I still, my phone still rings. I try to stay out of it. But there's a lot of good. There's a lot of good things about Hollywood, Florida. We have a lot of construction going on down here right now. Behind Coffee Cult, they're building 350 units. Apartments, and they're building 750, I think, two blocks away. And then across the street, I think we're getting 1,200 units. So the property values are doing quite well.
So does Coffee Cult do pretty well as a standalone business, the retail store, the coffee shop?
It does okay.
Yeah.
I don't know if it would be open without the rest of our business, but I think that maybe we do have a different business model, do it a little differently if we were doing that. So we bought this building. Standalone. Yeah. So this building we bought like 7 years ago, something like that, because it was the only thing I could find to buy.
Yeah.
It was big enough. They had, because we need natural gas as a roaster.
Yeah,
I needed to buy a building that had a gas line to it. So
is the back of house of that building, is that where all your roasting and packaging and everything is done? And then the front is a coffee shop? That's pretty cool. And so do you have like a glass wall or anything where people can see the roasting being done? Like can they see through windows? Glass door?
Yeah. Originally when we built it, we were going to have a huge glass wall, but then the roasters didn't fit right. And it just didn't lay out correctly. Yeah. So we put it to a glass door, but.
Yeah, in Canada, where I have my house, in the little town where I have my house, there's a brewer called Grizzly Paw, and they built this big, beautiful building for their new brewery, and they wrapped a restaurant around the top floor of it where you can see down to all of the whatever the things are called where you make beer in them, and you can do tours of the brewery as well. They take people on tours 5 or 6 times a day, and so it's pretty cool. I would think that you could probably run classes through there and all kinds of other things too.
We do once in a while. We had a tour yesterday.
That's cool.
And then we do like a cupping tasting experience. I'll kind of try to model it off of like the Bourbon Trail at the distilleries in Kentucky.
Oh, that's cool. Yeah, I think I told you, I came back from, I went to New York on business, and the guy that I was visiting there took me to this Starbucks, and I forget what it was called, but it's some special Starbucks in New York.
Starbucks Reserve.
Yeah, and they had this iced coffee drink that was like a bourbon barrel something or other. It was like $20 or something for a little thing of coffee, and I mean, it was one of the most amazing things I've ever tasted. I was blown away. I did not expect to even like it. I thought I was going to hate it because alcohol and coffee to me, like I've never really been into espresso martinis or any of that kind of stuff. I like coffee. I don't even like iced coffee. I like coffee, right? I don't like flavored coffee. I just like coffee. But this was amazing. Really nice stuff.
That's excellent. Yeah, the Starbucks Reserves are Starbucks answer to small coffee companies like us.
Yeah.
Live in 5,000 square foot buildings, and they open a 100,000 square foot building to show how they're a small artisan roaster.
Kind of funny. But that building blew me away. I mean, I walked in and just went, have you seen the one in I don't know what part of Manhattan it's in, but I just went, I'm just ching-ching in my head is starting to do the business and go, how the hell can this place make money? I mean, this is so expensive. This is such an expensive piece of real estate. And there had to be 50 people working in there, you know?
Right.
It was just crazy.
And the artwork. The wood underneath the bar, I don't know if you noticed, all hand-carved. I mean, crazy money.
Thing is, the guy who took us there was telling us the whole story. Like, he probably told us the wood under the bar is hand-carved. But, you know, that's the thing that a place, when you go that crazy and weird on an idea, that gets your customers telling your story for you. Now you know you've really done something right, you know, especially with such a watered down brand like Starbucks. You know, I think that's an interesting move on their part. I can't imagine it's profitable, but although a little cup of coffee for $20-something or whatever it was has to be profitable. So
when you have the volume that they have there, it was slammed, I'm sure, when you were there.
It actually wasn't. Like, that's the thing. We walked straight up to the little fancy bar thing and ordered three of these expensive coffee drinks. It wasn't that busy at all.
Normally the reserve
right away. Yeah. Yeah, no, it was a cool experience though. I was fairly blown away by it. I think I sent you a picture. I texted you a picture of the drink that I was having and the little card that said what it was, and you were like, yeah, whatever.
Yeah, that's coffee. You know, a lot of people, and people tell me all the time, they're like, oh, you must hate Starbucks. I'm like, no, I love Starbucks. They're like, you love Starbucks? Yeah. They taught people to drink, you know, $8
coffee. $7 coffee. Exactly. You're right. Like, without Starbucks, people would expect, people would expect 50 cent cups of coffee, you know,
right.
Like you get in a diner or whatever. They changed that.
It's expensive to produce quality coffee, though. The shipping, just at the farms, having the right trees. There's a lot to coffee, which is why when you brought up the decaf, how our decaf tastes different than other decafs, it really has to do with the quality of the coffee. A lot of people are just calling the decaf company, buying coffee and taking whatever they have. But we actually select our coffee before it's decaffeinated. And then we have it decaffeinated for us, and then it comes to us.
And what do they do to decaffeinate coffee? What's the process?
So there's two main processes in the world. There's probably five plants total in the world that do decaf coffee, like really do. I'm sure there's others, but in the main market, there's two different ways. There's adding chemicals to it and pressurizing the coffee. They actually put water and pressure and chemicals with pressure to separate the coffee from the caffeine from the coffee, and actually that caffeine goes to Coca-Cola or Pepsi, so it's used for other purposes.
Oh, so you keep the caffeine and it gets sold again or whatever. Oh, that's interesting.
And then the other way is water process, same way, as they're removing everything out of the coffee bean, and then they're do some chemical process with it. That removes the caffeine, and then they re-inject everything back into the coffee bean. So you either with chemicals or with water, and we use the water process.
Yours is damn good. Did you guys have to test like 20 different beans or whatever to come up with the one that you loved, or did you just get lucky?
I want to say we got lucky. I would say that from experience of knowing what we like and the processes and the supply chain is how it came about.
There's probably a cost too. Like, you know, like if you want a shitty bean, decaf, it's going to cost X. And if you want a really good one, it's Y. And most companies choose the shitty one.
Correct.
I think most companies really negate the decaf coffee drinker as, you know, you're not a real coffee drinker, you asshole. You know, I'm going to give you garbage. Here you go. But
they just see it as a line to a place to make money. Yeah. And there's decaf, and there it is.
Yeah. Yeah, but I wouldn't drink it if I didn't like it, you know, and I didn't. Like, I bought four cans of this Lavazo or whatever, and I think I still have three of them, you know, and finally got through one. But because it was kind of blended by the end, it was blended with the coffee cult stuff. So, yeah.
Well, that's on par with their regular coffee as well. So there's different qualities of coffee.
Yeah,
you know, some people sell coffee for $40 or $20 a pound, basically. Some people sell coffee for, you know, $9 for 2 pounds of coffee.
Yeah,
and yes, you're getting a good deal at 2 pounds of coffee, but it's not the best.
It's not coffee. The same. Yeah, yeah. I'm perfectly happy paying whatever your prices are, and I think the prices are fair, and it's very, very good coffee, and I dig it. I dig it. Dig awesome. It. Dig it. Yeah.
Thanks.
Well, and by the way, you know, I say it all the time on the podcast, but we appreciate very much what you did with the Geezer's Grind thing through Roby Backstage. I know we don't bring you a ton of customers through our audience, but we do bring you some. And the people who buy the coffee keep drinking it, not because of the charity, but because of the quality of the coffee, which is good. And that's why I drink it, by the way. I'd love to say I drink it because I'm feeding a charity. It's got nothing to do with that. It's honestly because I love the coffee. So, thanks.
And it's, I'm happy to do that. We also have a Road Dog blend, as well. That's kind of like what, like when I came up with that, I was like, this is what I needed when I got out, rolled off the tour back in the day. So that's what that's
for. Yeah.
Making coffee. Great. I miss entertainment business a little bit, not too much, but a little bit.
Well, anytime you want, I'll just give you a phone number and you can just jump on with some of our customers and stuff. We'll make you an honorary, you know, business development person or something. And then you won't miss the business for much longer again. You'll be like, oh, to hell with that, man. These people are nasty.
What's like the hot light right now? I mean, but when
you know, there's, it's weird. It's really weird right now because it used to be where Martin had this. High End had this, Verilite had this. They were all very different. If you wanted this, you got this one. If you wanted this, you got this one. Now they basically all have these homogenized product lines where everybody's got a beam, everybody's got a wash, everybody's got a spot, everybody's got a framing profile. Like they all have all the same stuff. And so it comes down to sort of different levels of quality and you kind of have tiers of quality. And so, you know, it's really like, I love Ayrton, not just because they sponsor my son, but because I think it's an amazing story and an amazing product line. They're sort of like top tier when it comes to all of the quality stuff, but they're also priced up there, right? Verilite has some really nice products now, and they're made in China by Acme. And Acme has some really great products under their own branding now. Chauvet is really good. Elation is excellent. Martin has a couple of really amazing lights. Martin just came out with a little tiny LED wash light called a Mac 1, which weighs like under 10 pounds and is, I think it's like 15,000 lumens or something, and it's under 10 pounds, full RGB, whatever, color mixing, and really, really nice. And they came out with this little four bar thing that you can either put four of them, that you pull them right out of the case, four of them on this bar, and you can either hang that bar or you can wall mount the bar. You can do all kinds of different things with it.
Smart.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's like all of the companies are good. Pick one and you can build a company around it very easily without missing anything. Like you might have a designer someday that comes to you and goes, well, it's got to be the ABC light or else, you know. Mm-hmm. Chances are most designs now allow alternates because they're all good.
They're not all like good. Not like the old days. You got a pile of cyber lights, you got a pile of Sharpies, you got studio colors, and that was the spec. And if you wanted a tour, you were buying those lights.
I mean, you still go through a little bit of that. Like right now, this Mac 1 thing from Martin, it's going to ship bazillions of them. It's going to be the Sharpie of 2024, I think. It's cheap. Like it's, I think it's like $2,000 retail, something like that. Wow. And so it's really cheap. You can buy 100 of them and do anything with it. Like you couldn't do a stadium or anything, but you know, any club gig, any theater, small venue kind of thing. Certainly for industrials, for corporate shows and convention booths and stuff, amazing light. So that thing I think is going to probably be the breakout success of 2024. But then LDI will come around again or Plaza later in the year and you'll have another two or three hot lights, you know. As far as control, it's still MA. Roby just bought Avo lights, which is kind of interesting.
Oh, wow.
And Avo has this thing called a D9, which is trying to bump off the MA3 and not really successfully yet. Like everybody says, yeah, it's a cool console, but then, you know, they sell 1,000 MA3s to every 10 Avalites consoles or whatever, right? So, but I think with Roby owning them, they now have bigger budgets, bigger manufacturing, lower costs, etc. So I think they're going to become powerful. Elation has a line of control called Obsidian, which is tucked in underneath all of that. They actually bought Case. They bought the old Martin Case console stuff. And so that became the foundation of the Obsidian control line, and really nice stuff. You know, it doesn't currently go up to like the MA3 or the biggest consoles. It's sort of like that Hog 2 range of stuff. And then Camsys is the other one that does really well. They're now owned by Chauvet. So yeah, I mean, it's the same but different, you know. Clay Packy's still strong, but not like they were. Like they don't have a Sharpie right now. They've got these laser fixtures. I don't know if you've seen any of that stuff. The Stylos, which is spelled X, I think it's XTYLOS, which is a moving light fixture but with a laser lamp source in it. So you get like these like 7 or 8 degree beams that go for a mile that are just sharp and bright and beautiful color and stuff. Really, really nice. And then they've got a new one called Skylos, which is the same thing, but even brighter, and it's meant to do sky beam kind of stuff or big stadium shows or whatever. But other than that, they have everything that everybody else does, a framing fixture, a beam fixture, whatever. And usually they'll have like a framing, a beam, and a wash and a spot. Most companies will have this at the sort of low level, which is like an LED, like a 300 watt LED. And then they'll have a mid range that's maybe a 500 or 600 watt LED. And then they'll have a really high output range for stadium shows and stuff that's like a 1,000 watt LED. And all the companies have that, you know. And now all the companies will have an LED strobe. All the companies will have an LED bar, you know, that does tilt but no pan. It's wacky. It's a wacky business. Good. And they're all successful. They're all kicking ass right now, selling as much shit as they can.
Is there do you know of, I would love to have to hang on my wall at my office, a Status Q console?
I'm sure I could find one. Maybe somebody listening to this might have one that they want to get rid of, but I would guess Mokri's probably got one kicking around somewhere. Maybe Bruce Jordahl, but I could certainly find you one. I'll make a little note here and I'll find you one.
Yeah, it just says a piece of art. That and a working, are there any more working Whole Hog 2s? Or are they all?
No, they're around.
Are they work? Yeah.
Yeah, you can get a working Hog 2.
Did someone start manufacturing the boards for them again?
Well, Mokri was getting them from somewhere, boards and screens. But I don't know where that's at right now. But I see Hog 2s for sale quite often, a couple grand kind of thing. MA1s you can get for like $1,200-$1,500, you know, which is crazy because they were 50 grand or whatever.
Right. Technology.
Yeah. No, I mean, you can get that stuff for sure.
Cool. I think I'm cool art for the office.
Yeah, that'd be really cool. People would walk in and go, what the hell is that? Exactly.
The Status Q taught me how to save my files. Control save.
Yeah. Status Q was such a...
I liked that console. I learned the LCD controller, and then the Status Q, and then the Hog 2.
Well, I think the worst thing that happened to the Status Q was the Hog 2, because if the Hog 2 didn't come out, maybe Status Q might have had more of a run, but it just got crushed. You know, it was just like, forget it. You know,
it was so big.
It just was... It was sort of nonsensical. The whole operating system was a little goofy, and it wasn't. Yeah, I don't know. It wasn't a Hog 2.
No, definitely not. The Hog 2 definitely killed the
Yeah.
Sure.
Well, Jamie, I appreciate you taking the time. I know you said you have a meeting at 11 or something, so we're going to have to get off of this, but I appreciate you taking the time. I love your coffee. I love your career. I think you've always been a really smart entrepreneurial thinker. By the way, another side story is you're the one who, and shame on you for doing this, you're the one who got my son into racing, because your son was actually in racing before mine was. And my son saw your son and talked to him, and he said, oh, it's amazing. Go-karts are amazing. And so Jeremy had to tried it. We've been doing it for 13 years since then. It's the reason I'm poor. And so thank you for that. Appreciate that.
You're very welcome. Much, Jeremy. You're welcome. I sold my kart quickly after that. I was like, oh, no. Yeah. But a lot of people don't know who your son, Jeremy, competes against some really, really well-financed teams like the Koch brothers.
Yeah. No, it's crazy. No, I mean, really, some of the kids we grew up racing with are half of them are in IndyCar now and still very well-funded, you know. Yeah. One of them went through Formula One. And, yeah, I mean, it's crazy the amount of money that gets thrown around. Like, I remember, you might even know Kyle Kirkwood from back in the days when you guys were karting. He was karting at Palm Beach. And he's like 22 or 23 now, probably. But I remember, like, probably the third or fourth time we were at Palm Beach, I met Kyle's dad, and we met Kyle. And, you know, Kyle at the time was probably 10 or 11. Jeremy was 7. And so Kyle kind of took Jeremy under his wing and taught him some stuff and showed him the lines a little better and helped him out a bit. And I was sitting on the picnic table behind the fence there talking to his dad. And I remember his dad, I asked him, so what's this really cost? Like, if we want to go beyond practice and get into some racing, what's it cost? And he said, well, it's a good question. He said, you know, it can cost a lot of different prices depending who you are. He said, we're on the low end of the spend. And we're scheduled to spend about 60 grand this year. And I almost fell off the picnic table right at that point. I was like, 60 grand. What? You know, because Ronnie, who ran the kart shop there, told me, oh yeah, you'll only need to buy a set of tires every month or so. And you know, the cart will last you a couple of years, no problem. And I'm thinking, wow, this isn't a very expensive sport at all. You know, now this guy's telling me 60 grand. And then when you get into it, you start to realize 60 grand doesn't go very far, you know, especially if you're doing big national series and stuff. You know, it's crazy sport.
That's good. I'm glad Jeremy's still racing. That's awesome.
Yeah, he is. You know, it's so ingrained in him. It's his passion, and I can't get him away from it. Like, I wish he liked soccer or basketball or football or something, you know, where it's a pair of shoes and a ball and, you know, here, I'll buy you 10 pairs of shoes. How's that? But he's doing it more on his own now, like where he's negotiating the deals, and he's, you know, I mean, in open wheel, a career is, you know, a very hard thing to come by unless you have a billionaire father. And so unfortunately, you know, he's looking at other things. He's looking at GT cars and all kinds of other stuff, but he's also doing some coaching and, you know, some real job kind of stuff as well. Because you gotta survive too. You gotta live.
Is he in Wellington now? Was he local? Or
yeah,
is
he's local. Yeah. He got back from England 6-8 weeks ago, I guess. And he'll probably, we're not sure yet what he's going to do this year. He's working on it.
Yeah. Cool.
So anyways, enjoy. Thanks a bunch for doing this. Thanks for what you're doing for the industry with Coffee Cult. Anybody who's listening, order this coffee. They always offer discounts and all kinds of stuff. You got to get 2 bags to get the shipping free, and, try it. I mean, you'll love it. I love it. It's amazing. Most of the people I know through our podcast who have gotten into it continue to rebuy it just like I do. You know, it's become part of their lives. So including Eric Loader from Elation, who sent me a picture the other day of him re-upping the coffee supply for the office. And
Knew Eric when I was like 17.
Did you really?
I've known Eric.
He was at American DJ at the time, or was he already at Trackman?
He was an American DJ.
Yeah. He's a good dude. One of my favorite people. So yeah. Really good guy.
Always very good to me. So thank you, Eric.
Yeah. Cool. Hi, Jamie.
All right. We'll see you later.
Yeah. Cheers.